Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. This week, I'm turning our attention from the playing field to the silver screen and taking a look at Lindsay Anderson's acclaimed 1963 film about a fictional rugby league player, This Sporting Life. This was an important film of its time. Richard Harris, who starred as a central character Frank Machin, was nominated for an Oscar and won Best Actor at that year's Cannes Film Festival. Rachel Roberts, who played Machin's landlady and lover, was also nominated for an Oscar and won a BAFTA award for Best Actress. The film itself was shot largely in Leeds and at rugby league grounds at Wakefield Trinity for the match scenes and Halifax for the external and post-match shots. Somewhat incongruously, however, a library shot of a crowd at Twickenham can be fleetingly glimpsed after Machin scores a try. The film also made full use of Wakefield Trinity's players, and the first words you hear in the film are spoken by Trinity coach and former Great Britain player Ken Traill. One of its most memorable scenes is a flowing movement leading to a try midway through the film, which is actually footage of Wakefield's 5-2 defeat of Wigan in the quarter-final of the 1963 Challenge Cup. The film is a very close adaptation of David Storey's 1960 novel of the same title, not least because Storey also wrote the screenplay, and much of the novel was taken from Storey's own experience. David Storey was born into a mining family in Wakefield in 1933, and he won a scholarship to the local Queen Elizabeth Grammar School. After he left school, he studied at London Slade School of Fine Art while playing rugby league for Leeds Reserve Grade A team at the weekends. He'd signed for Leeds at the age of 18 because, as he later recalled, "What I really wanted to do was go to art school. Taking the Leeds contract was going to be the only way I could pay for my education." Storey's life was that of the classic working-class grammar school boy, caught between two contrasting and conflicting worlds of his past and his future. "Being perceived as an effete art student often made the dressing room a very uncomfortable place for me," he later said. "But on the other hand, nor was his time at art school happy. At the Slade, meanwhile, I was seen as a bit of an oaf," he later remembered. Storey's ambiguity towards rugby league and his sense of alienation from his two worlds helped shape the novel and the film. The heart of the story describes the relationship between the rugby league player Arthur Machin and his widowed landlady Valerie Hammond. Their names were changed to Frank and Margaret in the film. And it combines a finely wrought understanding of the emotional entanglement of the couple with an accurate, if one-sided, description of the seamy realities of rugby league during those years. Machin is largely impervious to the world around him, while Mrs. Hammond is a woman crushed by the society around her. Both the novel and the film are part of what became known in the late 1950s as the British kitchen sink drama, which aimed, almost for the first time in mainstream British culture, to portray the lives of ordinary working class people in a realistic and sympathetic way. The most prominent examples of this type of drama were probably Alan Sillitoe's Saturday Night and Sunday Morning and his Loneliness and Long Distance Runner, as well as Sheila Delaney's A Taste of Honey. But This Sporting Life differs fundamentally from these films, because Frank Machin is not a rebel. He doesn't reject society's norms. His desire is to conform and to be accepted, but he cannot do this because of his inability to understand the rules by which he is expected to live his life. When This Sporting Life was released in 1963, it was welcomed by many people in rugby league for putting the sport in the public eye. Richard Harris was made an honorary president of Trinity, and its players and officials were invited to the West End premiere, but many others in the game were not so sure. Reviewing the film for the Rugby Leaguer, the sports weekly newspaper, Raymond Fletcher said, "My worst fears of the film were unfortunately realised." However, when looked at closely, the film is not actually about rugby league or sport. It's a film about relationships and the stifling conformity that crushes the human spirit and distorts relationships. Rugby league is part of the complex social structure that provides the context and the backdrop for the personal dramas that unfold. The game's acute sense of class and its roots in industrial working class culture are used by Storey to highlight the underlying emotional tensions of working class life with a directness that would be impossible using either soccer, where full-time professionalism distanced players from their local communities, or rugby union, which is obviously animated by a different middle class value system. You could almost say that if Tennessee Williams had been born in Castleford, Yorkshire, rather than Columbus, Mississippi, This Sporting Life is perhaps a type of screenplay he would have written. Subtle class distinctions, suffocating social norms, and transgressive and dysfunctional relationships are as central to This Sporting Life as they were to players like A Streetcar Named Desire. Indeed, Richard Harris's somewhat uneven performance, he never manages to master a Yorkshire accent, is rather obviously derived from Marlon Brando's portrayal of Stanley Kowalski in Elia Kazan's 1951 version of Streetcar. As with Williams' work, sex is central to This Sporting Life. In the opening scene, after Machin has his teeth broken by a stiff arm tackle that leaves him unconscious, The first thing that Ken Traill says to him is that you won't want to see any tarts for a week. Before he signs for the club, Machin's first encounter with the rugby league team is at a dance in the city centre, when he cuts in between a young woman and a player dancing. When told to get lost, Machin refuses, and the player says to him, "Do you want a thumping, love?" The use of the word love between two men, although common in usage in the Yorkshire coalfields until at least the 1980s, would have appeared to most viewers of the film to be at odds with the aggressively male world portrayed on the screen. What makes the film most interesting is that almost all of the relationships in the film fall outside of the boundaries of what would be assumed to be normal or respectable in the 1950s and early 60s. The main relationship is that between Machin and Margaret Hammond, the widow with whom he lodges. Mrs. Hammond's husband was killed in an industrial accident at the factory owned by the club chairman, Gerald Weaver, leaving her with two small children. The relationship between Machin and Mrs. Hammond is cold and almost entirely uncomfortable, even when he falls in love with her, and eventually results in him raping her. Mrs. Hammond is also significantly older than Machin. Her life experience, much of it tragic, is something that the much younger Frank does not understand. Their age difference is something that clearly falls outside of what is deemed to be a respectable relationship, as can be seen by the reactions of Mrs. Hammond's neighbours to Frank, especially when he gives her a fur coat, much to the silent disgust of her visiting friend. Machin's other relationship is that with club scout Dad Johnson, who Mrs. Hammond suspects is attracted to Frank. "He ogles you. He looks at you like a girl," she complains. Johnson's effeminacy is continually emphasised by Mrs. Hammond, who complains that he also has soft hands, and also in a scene where the players pass a ball to Johnson, who drops it, a show sign of effeminacy in this intensely competitive male world. Club chairman Gerald Weaver's interest in Frank also appears to be about more than rugby. Wonderfully played by Alan Bedell, he gives Machin a lift home in his car and ostentatiously puts his hand on Frank's knee, an act that Frank clearly suspects is about something more than mere friendliness. Machin's other transgressive relationship is with Weaver's wife, played by Vonda Godsell, who attempts to seduce him. Frank is clearly not the first player that Mrs. Weaver has invited back home. Arthur Lowe's character, club director Charles Slomer, tells Frank about what he calls Mrs. Weaver's weakness for social informalities. All of this highlights how this sporting life presents a range and a complexity of relationships in ways which had never previously happened in British films. This was because Lindsay Anderson and David Story, whether consciously or not, set up the film's shift in relationships against the norms of sport. Anderson, the public school educated gay intellectual, is the outsider looking in, and Story, the working class rugby league playing grammar school boy, is the insider looking out. Both understood that sport is a masculine straight world, in which might is right and weakness punished. This is a world that Frank Machin understands well, but Machin's mastery of that world puts him at a disadvantage in the real and complicated world of sex and personal relationships. That tension is the driving force behind the film. Although it can be argued that this sporting life presents an unfairly brutal and bleak portrait of rugby league, for example, you don't find any player expressing any enjoyment in playing the game, rugby league is only a vehicle for the film to present the complexity of human relationships against the oppressive conformity of gender roles and class distinctions. The portrayal of sport is rarely successful in films, but this sporting life is very successful. However, that is because it's not really about sport or rugby league at all. It's all about sex. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. If you want to follow me on Twitter, my name is @ColinsTony, and if you want to dig a bit deeper into the history and culture of rugby and the other football codes, take a look at the Rugby Reloaded website at www.rugbyreloaded.com. Until next week, thanks for listening.